Previously.
Hello, my name is Robert Carlyle, and I'm going to be speaking on the commentary with you today.
And my name is David H. Goodman, and I'm an executive producer and writer on the show.
And I'm Robbie Hall, and I'm a producer and writer on the show. And this is 308 Think Lovely Thoughts.
I should have told you I was the actor Robert Carlyle. I forgot about that.
And here we are, just coming up to speed on the episode. This is an interesting way to start a show. We're with two characters
we've never seen before.
Yeah. But we do know who they are, though, don't we? The little one, the mini-me in the background, though.
Is it strange to see you, the younger version of you, Bobby?
Yeah, I think they did a really, really good job in the casting, certainly physically. There's a couple of photographs of myself run about the same age. And there's real likeness, for sure. And he looks quite like my little boy, Pierce, in actual fact, my youngest son.
Wow.
Huh. Similar. And it was nice to work with Stephen as well, Stephen Lord there, who did a great job playing my dad.
He did a fantastic job.
He really did, because he'd actually, from what I gather, he had come along prepared with a Scots accent. And it was changed on the day. They decided against it on the day, so he had to kind of sort of backtrack. And because he doesn't really sound the way he sounds here either. He's from Manchester, Stephen. So he's got much more of a kind of, you call it kind of a Manchester accent, I guess, but he doesn't really sound like that. So he did a really good job in kind of trying to kind of balance up his own Manchester tone with a kind of standard English tone with a tiny, tiny little bit of Scots in there as well. So I thought he did a great job.
How is she?
I fear she's getting worse, Henry.
But if I save magic, she'll live?
Yes.
And here we are with Henry and Peter Pan. And I guess we can assume that anyone who's listening to the commentary here has already seen the episode, so we're not going to be spoiling. We're not going to be spoiling anything. But it's so nice to be able to cut from, from Stephen to Robbie here. In retrospect, watching it again and knowing you're going from this one guy to the same guy.
Same guy. It's one of those episodes. I think when people rewatch, it's going to be a completely different episode, which is when we were breaking and writing the story, we were so excited about. I can't wait for people to know who he is, and then they'll just go back and every scene will play differently.
You know, it's really true that I hadn't thought about that. That's true. So that cut between Stephen and Robbie there, that's for people who've already seen it and know what lies ahead. And this is myself and Regina wandering through Neverland, which was about 10 yards by 10 yards.
You're just walking in circles.
I tell you, that's basically what we're doing. It was such a small area, and really the hats off to every single director that came through in the first 11 episodes of season 3 to make it look as though we were in actual fact in some kind of expanse or some kind of wilderness, because I can assure you we certainly weren't. And it was a case of, when you see these cuts here, we were kind of backing up, maybe 10 feet or so, then walking again into these spots. So it was really quite a technical exercise. Even a small scene like this became quite technical in terms of the pacing.
Pacing and camera, that's what's so much easier to just write. Interior Neverland.
Yeah, the interior Neverland, fantastic.
Good
here
luck.
We go. Yeah, off you go. Round in your 10-yard circle.
And here we are with Rumble being brought to the Spinsters, which I was looking back. We first heard about the Spinsters in the season 2 episode Manhattan, when the seer told Rumple, or told the audience that he had been raised by spinsters. And here, a season later, we're actually getting to see them, which is sort of a satisfying a thing to have laid in season 2.
Yeah.
Which is fun, because often when we're looking for plot points in which the direction of the story is, we get so excited, we're like, oh my gosh, remember the spinsters? Yeah. They could be going to the spinsters. And then we feel very, very smart when it was all happenstance.
I had forgotten that. Forgotten. The spinsters had been already spoken about.
When we had originally written the scene, I think there was 3 of them, and we had written this really rapid-fire kind of Bradbury-type witches that were just saying one word at a time, and then we looked at it and thought, that's going to be impossible.
It was kind of reminiscent of the three witches in Macbeth or something.
Yes.
Like that.
Yes.
And here we are in Neverland again.
Yep.
You know what makes these scenes easier? More people.
More people. This is actually, I think, if I'm right in saying, I think this is actually exterior here. Yeah, okay. This is exterior. This is down by the banks of a place called Manatee Bay, which is halfway between Vancouver and a place called Squamish. And really lovely, lovely spot. And I remember this night, actually, because I think I'm about to come into this scene as well. And it was really, really warm for some bizarre reason. But you can see the match there between, you know, this is the real, true exterior and the Neverland set. You see the water in the background there. It shows you how well that matches up, because you really couldn't tell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Great stuff by the lighting team there, you know.
What are you two doing here? Same as you, except we actually have a chance. Pandora's box.
This is the point, of course, when Gold is kind of trapped.
Yeah, it was really interesting because Robbie and I also wrote the episode 4, Nasty Habits, where, you know, Bobby, where Rumpel and Neil had their sort of their episode together. And so it was really gratifying to be able to then do this kind of this bracket scene where the two of you are brought together again and the secret. Yes. About the prophecy has to be revealed to everybody else.
That's right. I thought great job you guys did in episode 4 as well. That was really, really enjoyable. And myself and Michael actually had spoken about that many, many times about how much we'd enjoyed that, so
it turned out very well on your shoulders. Yes. So thank you.
Every time we get assigned episodes, like, oh, Bobby episode, great, fabulous.
Yeah, leave it all to me, it's fine.
Yep.
It's interesting looking at this scene, you know, there are so many echoes the longer the show goes on. And I think when we were looking at this scene, here's a scene where young Rumpel believes that if he can get a job and he has a talent, then he can help his father and his father can be good. And it reminded me so much of the Rumpel Bay scene when Bay finds out there's a knife that controls you, that controls Rumpel, and that if he can find a land without magic, you know, maybe he can have a relationship with his father, and just sort of the echo of that generation back to this generation.
No, absolutely. It's really, really beautiful, that, for sure. Of course, in the very first hint of Rumpel being a spinner here and being able to do this is where he gets his talent originally from, and these ladies. He did very well, young Wyatt. He really, really did. Of course, he's not Scottish at all. He's from Arizona or something like that. I don't know.
No, we thought he did a great job. And we had a lot of talk when we were breaking the episode of could this age really carry an episode? And we felt it was so important to really see him as a young boy and see that kind of circle that he was trying to break, that Bay will try to break, and just kind of fathers and sons and how things tend to repeat even when you don't want them to.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was a pleasure, you know, to take part in this episode for sure. So I mean, I enjoy them all. You enjoy them all for different reasons, you know. Particularly, of course, when something's centred on your own particular character, you know, you look forward to these episodes. You look forward to playing it, and you guys and the rest of the writing team always doing an absolutely fantastic job.
Thank you. I mean, I think I probably have said this the last time I did a commentary, but it's like when you have a villain like this who cannot possibly be characterized as a villain. You have so many places to go that you don't on a lot of shows where the bad guys wear the black hats and the good guys wear the white hats here. And you have been able to wear a wonderfully gray hat and continue to wear it.
A very muddy gray hat.
Yeah.
But especially in scenes like this, because to have the few years of seeing Rumpel as Rumpel, but every time you talk with Bay, it's so fun to write those really emotional scenes where you guys are really digging in.
Because it's so truthful, guys, you know, that's why it's you know, nothing's easy, but, you know, you make the job easier because it's so very truthful, you know, that he's not 100% anything. Rumpel, you know, he just isn't, you know, and even at his absolute worst, you know, when he's absolute, you know, baddest, he's still generally got a point.
Right.
You know, that's why people, I think, the audience respond to that character as well as they do, because they think, well, they can't hate this guy, you know, because he speaks fact.
I think there's a wonderful line between sort of evil and damaged. And so once you have that, which is what this episode really dug into, too, just when you have that damage, I think people can connect with and forgive any number of things when they know it's coming from that.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Just a little Easter egg, I think. In this scene, you hear Malcolm, Rumpel's dad, call him Laddie. And specifically in episode 4, Peter Pan calls Rumpel Laddie before we ever know Peter Pan's true identity. And that was another way just to try to show the audience, we didn't just come up with this after episode 4. We've been planning this for a long time.
I've got an idea, quick. No, absolutely. No, it was very clever. I remember when Robbie actually said that to me in the scene, I was like, ouch. that's going way back, that one.
There must be some place special to you.
This is a real moment, this, isn't it? It's like, this is where Rumpel gets his bad decisions from, you know? And, right back to this moment here.
And we hear in the scene also with him talking about his own father and being abandoned with the blacksmith, and just kind of, again, we talk a lot in the room about just that cycle of abandonment and bad choices and how it kind of filters through to the next generation.
And even if you wanted to take it further than that, not that he does, because he doesn't realise, but of course, you know, Neil, you know, parts with Emma and she goes off and then gives up this child. You know,
absolutely.
And, you know, of course, it's not exactly what this. It's not deliberate in that respect. The way that the Rumpel parts would be, but there's a similar kind of.
It still follows that pattern, even if it's circumstance.
Absolutely, absolutely. So here we go again. You know,
here we go, quite literally.
Yeah, and off they go. Where are we? I can't remember. We're in the studio, we're outside, I think. Nah, we're in the studio again. Again, that's that path that went myself in the original scene, the first scene there with the Regina. That's the other way.
Looks totally different.
It's all that is.
You guys are like Wile E. Coyote walking by that same rock over and
same
over.
Place.
You know what? I realize why we can't find Henry. We keep walking in a circle.
If they just kept going to the bottom.
That's the power of Neverland. You can't leave. You just continue to pace back and forth.
You just go around in ever-decreasing circles.
I love in this scene, even though, you know, Rumpel or Mr. Gold has been somewhat tamped down, he's still very willing here to try to extract a price here, you know, even though they've said don't do it.
I love that. That's right. He's, I'll help you if... He can't resist it. He just can't resist it, can he?
That's who he is.
What's your price?
Yeah, the price.
Quite the favour.
I mean, what he's talking about is saving someone's life. He's saying, well, you know, I'm doing you a favour here, you know?
Well, and also the comment, too, about... He has, you know, experience with poison, considering he got poisoned by the pirate who's standing next to him.
The
cowardly pirate.
Some episodes ago.
Indeed. Of course, Neil's not having it at all, is he?
We're here.
One of my favourite lines is coming up here. I'm not getting in there with nothing but my good looks. I loved that.
I remember looking at Robbie over the computer when that was written. That is nice. Really? That is nice to hear.
Magic, I agreed, but I'm not walking in there with nothing but my good looks.
Oh, I, on the other hand.
I often say that before I head into the writer's room.
It's always great when the scripts make you laugh, you know? And there we are. Again, you know, this is just... This is the little encampment here. It's literally the size of a small lounge.
This is a great moment right here when you give this line to her and she gives you this really good look.
That tree, that big tree there, that big polystyrene tree, that was... look at that. See that there? That is it. That's as big as the whole place is, that shot there.
That's amazing.
It doesn't get any wider than that at all.
Henry?
He's got to be somewhere.
Where? Help!
And here we have the discovery of Wendy. Freya Tingley, who ended up being a really great actress. I mean, I don't know that anyone ever thought we would see her again after the Darling episodes at the end of last season, but you know, she was good, and if you're good, you come back.
Well, that's it. You know, you can never leave, yeah. Never let you go.
No. If you're good, we want you back.
I tell you what's extraordinary about Freya is that, she's about 22.
Yeah.
22, 23. I mean, you would never know.
Right.
Look at her. She looks about 12 years older. And that's not just a physical thing. She's acting that as well. And she,
sure.
Again, she's really, really projected that absolutely correctly.
My own father abandoned me.
She's like, we go.
And here we go from,
I think this is also like the Manatee Bay area I was talking about earlier, that other scene when we were in the woods. This is it in the daylight.
And here we are in Neverland, and of course, when we wrote it, it was like, it's sunny out, there are flowers and grass everywhere. And then
it's a magical
place. We're shooting in Vancouver, so you know
it's
what?
It's Vancouver, come on.
It's beautiful in a different way.
Of course,
it is
a very
quite,
damp way.
Well, it is gorgeous.
Damp, windy. Yeah, you can see the wind there, actually, even the trees beyond.
Go on, just think it.
This little bay here kind of was used quite a few times, I think, in the future episodes when Ariel appears disappears.
I think you may have even killed a squid there in the last.
Right.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
There was some death, some salmon. they were actually coming to, I think, to spawn around about that time, I think, around about the aerial episode. And there was some of them dying while she was in the water.
Oh, my gosh.
They were kind of dying around about her. It was really kind of weird experience to see these things that were
charming.
Coming to the end of their life right in front of her eyes, you know.
I love the disappointment Stephen plays here in terms of having, you know, he thinks he's back in Neverland, and it ain't like he remembers it, at least not for him.
That's it.
Pixie dust.
And the fact that you see so early on that Rumpel just wants to be somewhere to start over with his dad, but his dad is still has an agenda.
Yeah. I know, it's actually a kind of horrible, a kind of abandonment thing that's going on here, you know?
Yeah, if you think about it, you didn't turn out
bad choices.
You didn't turn out half bad. Now, if you think about it,
no, I mean, I think so.
It's not like you're robbing fairy tale liquor stores.
Considering, look, he looks all right. Even though he's going to kill Wendy.
Another such a wonderful moment. It's like here the little girl is just trying to like protect herself, and here comes.
Yeah,
she's lying.
I'm going to have you with a sword on it.
And just your justification, the great, just I've basically lied enough to know. To be able to spot another liar.
That's true. I can spot another liar. That's exactly right.
Another thing, listen, these big scenes, they're a challenge to write, and I imagine they're even more of a challenge to act. When you have so many people in frame and you're parsing out the dialogue to make sure everybody's alive.
It's very, very difficult, actually. But as a
fan, when you watch it and everyone's in the same space. It is such a pain, but when you watch it, especially on a show like this, when you have such a strange family here, you know, of parents who are the same age and two real villains who are also part of the family and a fairy and a pirate captain all in one shot. It's nice.
It's fun for us. So many times your storylines are spread out and, you know, a pair is doing this and Rumpel and Regina doing this. And even talking about Neverland early on, we're so excited to just have everybody together and kind of the conflicts and the strain that would put on everybody. And it was so fun to have all characters available for whatever we wanted them to do.
I can imagine it would be sort of really, you know, satisfying from a writing perspective. It is very difficult from an acting perspective, though, because you especially when there's gaps, you know, and there's one line coming here and there. See, keeping the concentration, you know, to manage to kind of be in the right place, at the right point. That's the discipline. That's the talent or the skill right there to be able to do that. And that the onus is on everyone. You know, no one can allow the ball to drop at all. And it kind of continued like that really through the whole of the first 11 episodes, doesn't it, of season 3. We have many of these scenes where there's a group. Stuff going on, and it's tough. It's a tough ask on the actors, though.
Now, just along those lines, and obviously, you know, here we are with Henry and Skull Rock. Bobby, what's it like playing some of these scenes where you're on a green screen and there's barely anything around you? I mean, talk about sort of acting challenges.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, to be honest, many years ago when I very first was acting in green screen stuff and other movies and stuff that I've done, I found it really, really, really tough, really difficult because there's, you know, as you say, there's nothing there but green all around about you. But in Once Upon a Time Land, in Fairy Tale Land particularly, I really enjoy it because it's Rumpelstiltskin, particularly when I'm in the full kind of Rumpelstiltskin mode with the green and stuff like that, that's very theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone's very, very theatrical, very, very big. I play them very big. And you can the kind of expanse of that green screen stage
Wow.
is so
that's
huge
all around
right. about you that you kind of try and fill that entire space. And I've come to love it in actual fact. In these, in actual fact, my favourite scenes are the stuff that's in the green screen these days. So a long journey for me, you know, a good 20 year journey to get to that point. But I think I'm kind of finally there now that I've come to terms with it and embrace it. It's maybe a little bit more difficult if you're playing a character who's a little bit less or a little bit smaller,
uh-huh.
because that's what you can't afford to do in the green screen stage, and especially in the fairy tale stages. You have to kind of fill that place. You have to be as big as you can possibly be, I believe.
I'm tired.
We're almost there. We can rest all we want after we get the pixie dust.
I'm not sure where they are now. This is an entirely different bit of the woods.
Bit of damp, another part of damp Vancouver woods.
It looks cold there as well, doesn't it?
What is the process in terms of when you first got the part and you're building sort of, I imagine you would need to build some kind of a history for yourself, and that's in your head, and then as the show progresses, we fill in these pieces, and you have to make, is there a push and pull to making what you always imagined work with what ends up being on the page, or are you just so flexible that's easy, or is it hard, or is it like, I never imagined this is a way? I mean, here we are watching your childhood, and you must have thought about that when you were building the character, or no?
Yes, you do, but I think the word you used there, I think, is correct. It's flexible. You have to kind of roll with the punches a lot of the time, because, you know early doors that nothing's been written. It's not there. It's until you get there, basically, it's not going to be in front of your face to read. So you have to be flexible, and you have to be prepared to kind of like adapt. But particularly with Rumpelstiltskin, I'd always wanted to try and make this guy difficult to understand, but difficult to love, but difficult not to love at the same time. So this is what I've always been trying to do, and a lot of the influences that are there with certainly the green Rumpelstiltskin. These are characters from my childhood in here. There's a lot of kind of British music hall characters, comedians. People that were very, very big in my imagination when I was a child, and I've kind of brought these kind of music hall uh-huh. people into it, and I never thought I'd ever play a character like that. I never thought a character like that could actually exist on a screen because he's so theatrical. But the longer that the show has went on, the more, and especially the way you guys write it, it's been easier and easier for me to do that and to try and depict this bizarre, otherworldly guy.
But what's so fascinating about that, too, is even you're saying your desire to play him as, you know, impossible not to like and impossible to like at the same time. Like, clearly we pick up cues from your performance, and there is something from your performances episodes ago that is informing our creation of this version of an origin story. It's just a wonderful creative loop that you can only do over the many years of a TV show. It would be, you know, you don't get to do this in a 2-hour movie.
What I find now with particularly with the green, if we call them the green Rumpelstiltskin, that it's kind of already there on the page for me now, whereas in the early part, you know, particularly in the first season, I was kind of trying to make it work. Uh-huh. A bit more, if you know what I mean. I was having to try and kind of manufacture a lot of this stuff, but it's kind of on the page now because you guys have seen what I do. You can almost hear it coming, you know, particularly when I change accents or I change voice or, you know, I sing things sometimes. I mean, you guys are you know, that's possibly going to be there when you're writing it. So I don't know how you would describe what you're doing, but you're laying it kind of open for me to interpret in exactly the way that I want to do it these days. This here, interesting. This is an interesting thing. See this rowing the boat up to the Skull Rock. Right. that was a few of us in a rowing boat on the green screen stage, but nothing there, nothing at all. No water, no nothing. Right. So you're just in a boat, which is like there was a, I think it was a stunt guy in actual fact who was at the back of the boat rocking it back and forward. So you've really got to just let your imagination run wild at moments like that and just try and be there. Don't think too much about it. Don't think I'm in a little fishing boat in the middle of a green screen stage with a stuntman rocking it back and forward. You kind of let that enter your mind. You know, you've just got to kind of let your imagination go.
The spell is designed to keep anyone who casts a shadow from entering.
This little beat here, I think, is one... A great thing that came out of Robbie and I writing episode 4 and episode 8, which is they had this big conversation in 4 about Neil not believing that his dad had given his shadow the knife and gone away.
Yeah.
And he didn't believe it. And here the chicken comes home to roost, and they get what essentially is a nice emotional payback to that, where Neil realizes when Rumpel can walk through the spell... that his dad wasn't lying, and there's just nice connective tissue there.
No, absolutely. I remember even playing this scene and thinking that. I thought it was a lovely moment that he was actually, he was telling the truth.
Which is funny, which Rumpel usually does. I mean, you might not press him enough for the smaller points or the details, but he's...
Don't look too deeply into
it. He's above lying. He'll tell you the truth. You're just, he's going to outsmart you either way.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely right.
So what are we supposed to do now?
What about the spell my father...
This little set here was extraordinary, because this is inside the stage, obviously, yep. And you see the water there. It was really tiny, tiny little area. But it really works remarkably well.
What, you mean like an eclipse? Is that even possible?
Maybe. So?
The other thing I'd meant to kind of mention there earlier on when you said that about the... his shadow. That was a complete nightmare for the DOPs through 11 episodes, because I do have a shadow and I do cast a shadow, and it was really difficult for them to try and make that vanish. And again, that's as you said early on in the commentary there, when the people are looking back, these are the things that they might look for and go, well, can you actually see his shadow?
And the production, you know? People on this show, I mean, they are second to none. The show looks so amazing.
So stunning.
And like you just said, I mean, that's like the idea of shooting a vampire movie in a hall of mirrors. Like, it couldn't be stupider.
Right.
And here they are making it work.
I know. I don't know how they did it. I really don't know how they did it, because I was very aware of it. And when I was standing on the set and stuff like that, I kept on saying, can they see this shadow? You know, they can't see this shadow. I said, don't worry, it won't be there. fair enough.
Thank goodness.
I'll trust you.
We wonder why we don't get called more often, with people going, what? What? Have you thought this through? No. We go, no. Looks good.
No, that's your job. We just write it. Yeah. Again, all of this, you know, green screen. Fantastic, you know, nothing there at all, other than a couple of green boxes. So it really is hard to believe. It really is hard to even looking at it.
Here's another sort of echo scene. I mean, we're leading up to Rumpel's dad coming in and abandoning him, and again, just thinking about the scene between Rumpel and Bay, where he made the decision and couldn't go through the portal to the land without magic. And here we are, have a sister scene to that, again, informing, obviously, Rumpel's decision with Bay years later.
Yeah.
But when I tried using it, it didn't work.
This is very upsetting, by the way, guys. All of this this moment with when he's abandoned like that, and then the...
It's heartbreaking.
The shadow comes.
And again,
tough.
A lot to be said for Stephen Lord's performance here. I remember when we were watching audition tapes, he came in with I think we imagined him as being softer, and this turn as being more of a turn in the story. And his performance in the audition tape was much more. He was clearly a huckster from the start. He was clearly a guy who had his own best interest at heart over his child's. And it was very interesting. We were wondering, would it work? But he was so good that it was like, well, look, we'll take the best actor that's making his own decisions over a bad actor who's playing it the way we think he should be played.
Yeah, well, good choice.
And when it cuts together here, again, the audience has had a bad feeling about this guy the whole time, but it doesn't change the fact that this scene is heartbreaking.
It's hard, and he plays it so not as remorseful as I thought in my head. And again, not to echo David, but it's just when actors make those choices and you haven't seen them in your head, and they go, "Wow, that's not at all what I envisioned," and it's fantastic.
And it works.
And it works.
For sure. I know. So awful.
A child can't have a child, Rumpel.
And of course, you know, the two of them are a little team. Those two, they did incredibly well in that episode, and they worked so well together. And you can see it even here. You know, it's not easy to do that. You know, and to bring up that level of emotion, you know, and especially in a kid. It's so well done.
Yeah. You did a great job. And here are the other shoe drops. Anyone who hadn't gotten it to it before, oh my gosh. Rumpel's dad is Peter Pan.
I was myself and Robbie were the only two that knew that from the beginning of season three. The rest of the cast didn't know it, no one yet.
Oh,
None of the crew either, so.
And tell us about the process. I mean, was that Adam and Eddie calling and saying, hey, guess what? I mean, what was that conversation like?
Yeah, that was basically it. It said, we've got a surprise for you. you know Peter Pan? Yeah, well, he's your dad. Like, what? How does that work? So it was fantastic, you know. I mean, they explained the process and what hopefully. I mean, this is way, way back, of course.
Sure.
Some of these episodes weren't even written.
Yeah.
But they kind of explained roughly how it was going to work, and it's not as ridiculous as it sounds, you know. Like, Peter Pan is your father. That's a really difficult one to take in, you know.
And what was it like playing this scene here with Robbie Kay, or playing scenes with him? We felt so lucky to have gotten him in the role. He did such an amazing job. And he stands toe-to-toe with you here, which is no easy feat.
Yeah. Many have tried and failed.
That's the skulls of them, actually, lying in the background.
Look at all the top-of-show skulls.
No, absolutely. Robbie was an absolute pleasure, a real pleasure to work with the lad. And absolutely belies his years. I mean, what is he, 19?
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic, you know, and he was very strong and easy, just easy. A real maturity about the boy, you know. He was not just when he was acting as Peter Pan, but off screen as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, the two of us were chatting away as if we were the same age, you know. It was just absolutely wonderful, you know. And so I think that was part of it, why we got on so well. We became good buddies. And it was very easy for us to kind of play the scenes together. And it's lovely. I've always said this. I've said this many, many times in my career. I love watching younger actors. I love it. And you can learn a lot from them if you're concentrating, if you're really on it. You can learn from them. And I certainly learned a lot just watching Robbie and the way that his, in terms of his approach and of his passion and his intensity, I thought was absolutely fantastic. And I don't know. Is he going to be coming back? I don't know. We don't know. I'd certainly welcome that.
We leave every option open.
Yes, and, as we said, no one leaves.
And, and just to talk about the other side of the scene, which is your side, which is, listen, you're acting against a 19-year-old who's your dad, and the stuff we see on your face in terms of, it looks like you're looking at your dad, and I mean. Yeah. That can't be easy, and it all just comes through here. It's really wonderful.
Oh, thank you for saying that. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for saying that. I mean, it's really just focus, you know. It's just focusing on it and seeing through that young face, you know. And I kept seeing Stephen to a certain extent. Uh-huh. You know? I kept on seeing him there and seeing that kind of that older face behind those eyes. And but Robbie made it easy because, again, that kind of maturity that he has for one so young. Was there for all to see right in these moments, so it was, he made it easy for me. And he put me in the box.
you put in the box, which, by the way, a very cool box. I love that little spinning wheel. It was a good prop.
You know, that was that didn't really work, to be honest. I mean, it kept on. There was a little kind of lever at the bottom of it, which you had to kind of sort of very slyly put your finger under it and try and get it to work. And so it was very funny sometimes. Some of the outtakes would be funny with me doing that kind of circular motion over it with nothing happening. He's lost his powers. And even him and Robbie got it on the other side. It was like he was doing the same thing. So this isn't working.
I lost him.
Oh, well, we'll make you another one.
You could give it as we get a look at they're talking about the doll that he's lost, the Cornhusk doll, and there it is. You know, obviously, for people who have been watching the show, we established that, and I want to say the premiere of season 3, when Felix comes and hands it to you, Bobby. What, obviously, you'd had the conversation with Adam and Eddie that you knew Peter Pan was your dad, but what do you do to impart that earlier scene? Because I remember you hold it, and you cry. I mean, it's as emotional as we've seen you get. What's it like, without having played these episodes, which obviously chronologically happened first, what's it like getting ready for a scene like that to make a corncob doll, which means nothing, mean something?
Well, you know, you've just got to look at this little thing in your hand, this little doll, and you've just got to imagine the sadness of that. You know, this rather pathetic little toy. And imagine that this was your only friend, and let yourself really sink deep, deep, deep down into these quite dark places, you know, in an actor's mind sometimes, that you go back. Sometimes it's your own life, sometimes it's stuff that you've heard from other people's life, and you try and bring these emotions up and show them in the windows of the soul, which is your eyes. So it's not an easy thing, but neither is it difficult, especially when you have, you know, the little doll was just so brilliant. I don't think it could have been any better a thing in order to bring those emotions out of me. It was a beautiful thing.
Well, and it's so funny to be surrounded by a bunch of CG backgrounds as people are looking at right now, and then have that small
little doll,
real prop.
Well, that's it. You see, sometimes that's what grounds you, though, isn't it? That's the reality of that, you know. Because what I thought about actually at one point, I can't give you this. When I was very young, I had I remember going to see the Aristocrats film, mm-hmm. the Disney, I think it was, cartoon with the cats, with my dad, and we were poorer than poor. And when we left the cinema that night, it was one of the first times I ever remember seeing merchandise, a little stall of stuff, which was in the foyer of the cinema. And they had these dolls of the cats. And there was a little one, in the Aristocrats, there was a band of cats that played the guitar and the drums and the banjo and stuff like that. And there was a little blue cat, which I had loved in the film. And even though we had you know, less than nothing, my dad said, "Okay, you can have this," and he bought me this little cat, and I carried that with me for about 5 years, 6 years, easy. The tail, I used to put the tail in my mouth and just chew the tail, and I had this for years and years and years and years. I took it absolutely everywhere with me, and that Peter Pan Cornhusk doll was that cat. And that was an easy step to kind of, you know, to bring up those emotions from the past for me.
Wow.
Wow. Don't be surprised if you now have a cat in season 4. Because that would make it... If we just talk more, our jobs would be a lot easier.
Tell you what, we should really, shouldn't we? I can give you the lot.
It's going to save all of you.
No, it's not. This was never about magic, Henry. You have to believe us.
Well, this is Henry making a choice now, isn't it?
Yep, he wants to save magic.
Yeah, I know. God, that's beautiful. Sacrifices himself, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting when we were writing the scene, which was a challenge to get Henry to the place. We used a lot of language related to heroism, you know, like, yes, heroes having to make sacrifices and choices, and a hero always being tested, to really chart Henry trying to sort of walk, he thinks he's walking in the footsteps of something his mom would do. He thinks he's doing maybe not the popular thing, but the thing that needs to be done. And obviously he's been, you know, brainwashed by Pan here.
Yeah, but he says it's just his determination to be a hero and to do the right thing is what pushes him to making his weird decision. Again, Robbie's great again in this scene, isn't he?
Great.
Making it very, very real.
And then in classic fashion, you know, if we know what he's going to do, we want to go around the world here checking in on Henry's parents, all three of them, giving him their arguments and wanting to feel like, you know, maybe, just maybe they're getting through.
Yeah, I know. That's right. That's it.
Uh-oh. He gives that smile and then boom.
It's over.
And now you have to get out of a box.
Well, that was difficult, I have to tell you. It was very dark in there.
Yeah, Bobby, what are you playing when you're in the box? That must be very hard.
Well, you know how method I am. I blindfold myself for several weeks.
Well, that was an absolute pleasure.
Was that it?
Pleasure.
Oh, that was a pleasure. I really enjoyed that, guys. Thank you so much.
Us too. Thank you, Bobby. Thank you. And thanks to everybody who's watching. And Absolutely. Keep watching.